This show furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervy and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervy. I'm the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here on this beautiful Sunday afternoon to be the managing partner of your life. And here with me, of course, is my beautiful co-host, Carrie Kasem.
Oh, there we go. There's
you
my
put
mic.
Your mic on.
Thanks, Wayman.
Wait, how many years have you been in radio?
That wasn't me.
I'm not going to throw anybody under the bus.
I'm not going to throw anybody, Wayman.
He's always on top of things. You know, I wish I could sit here and talk to you, but we got things to do, Carrie.
Yes.
Stop laughing. I got a lot to talk about because I want to talk a little bit about your conference coming up, and I want to talk about. And I told you that your picture's on the wall, the field at the Sunrise Little League.
Yes.
But we don't have time to talk about this because, you know, we have Stephanie Wong Briall with us, and she is an award-winning filmmaker, commercial director as well, and she's going to tell us a little bit about her film, New York Times critics pick Blown Up, and she has to be out. She's busy.
Blowing up.
That's what I said.
Blowing in the wind. It's blowing up.
Blowing up. You know, she's fitting us in, and we appreciate it because she's got a busy schedule, and she's only got a few minutes with us, for us a few minutes, because with other shows, you know, a few minutes is a few minutes. With us, a few minutes is 20 minutes.
20 minutes. It's a good chunk of time.
Well, let's not waste it. So Stephanie Wong Briall has this, say it again, Blown Up. It's a documentary story of sex work in the legal system, and it's really interesting because it chronicles the courtroom where Japanese American judge Toko Sarita in Queens presides, and they talk about the complexities of prostitution and trafficking, and
the differences as well, which is very interesting because a lot of people think, well, if you're a prostitute and you're young, you've been trafficked, and there is a choice, and that was very interesting to see that, even though it's not really a choice because sometimes the poverty level is so bad and what got you there, but it shows kind of all aspects of it.
And you know, Stephanie is no stranger to successful documentaries. She did Tough Love and Woe I Knee Mommy, which means I love you, Mommy. And there are so many interesting issues here. Stephanie, thank you for taking the time on the Sunday afternoon to be with us today.
Thank you, guys. I'm so excited to be here and talk to you guys.
And I know it's not afternoon. You're in New York right now?
Yes, I am.
Oh.
I'm in New York
City.
Evening. Yes. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested, because I read somewhere that you had gone to Judge Sarita's courtroom for many months before actually putting this film together, and you were observing and making sure you were going to get it right.
Yes. So we started this project in 2014 when Tough Love was finishing its festival circuit. And I had read an article about this specific courtroom in the New York Times, and I wanted to check it out because it had was serving a population of women that my previous work had touched upon. And it was being led, like you said, by an Asian female judge. And I was also just so curious in terms of, like, what does that look like? What does it mean when you're changing the way you're prosecuting women who are arrested for prostitution? And you're doing this within the confines of the criminal justice system. What does that mean and what does that look like? And so I went to the courtroom and I met Judge Sarita and I met the stakeholders. And, you know, as when I told them who I was, they're very kind to me, but they're all like, oh, that's very, you're very nice. We think you're a very earnest filmmaker, but, you know, we're not going to let you come into here because
exactly.
Like, this is such a sacred space and there's so much trauma and our clients are going through so many things. Like, this is you're just asking something that's too big.
And don't use them for your own good.
Yes.
And it took about 10 months, correct? Before you won over everybody's trust.
Well, so, you know, I say now, like, you know, it took us 10 months to get the judge's permission to bring cameras into the courtroom. But from there, every single person that was participating had to get their own permission and consent. And every scene after the courtroom, because the film opens with, like, sort of cinema verite, immersive style filmmaking inside the courtroom. And then Act 2 and Act 3 is a little bit different in style. But, you know, from there, I had to get every single scene there on was, again, a conversation, a discussion that took maybe 3 to 4 months before the filming actually took place, with the counseling sessions, with the judge outside of the courtroom, with Eliza, et cetera.
Stephanie, did you have any problems with getting consent? Because we have a lot of people on the show, directors, and they're telling real stories with real people's lives. People always ask us, how do these filmmakers get the consent, and how can they make an effective film when this is real?
Yeah, no, these people, their lives are very different from my life. So I totally understand their hesitation, their concern, their fear of repercussion from whatever forces are in their lives for doing something like this. So I have total respect, and I give them a lot of options in terms of filming. And that's why I say, like, every single scene took many conversations, and those conversations were like, well, what do you want to do? What don't you, what can we not show? You know, so we understood the barriers going into it. And then we would come back with a creative framework of how we could film this and why we wanted to film this. And through those long discussions, you know, they agreed. And so consent is a big word of this day and age right now. And it's an important word. And I think that, you know, every single frame in the film has intention and consent involved.
Now, I don't want to give too much away. I don't want to talk about the characters exactly, but there were some people where it's like, it seemed like, hey, look, they've been given another chance, like this one woman. But yet her choice was to go back into prostitution, even though, was it just that she didn't find that the programs or the help was enough? What is that mentality that's like, I'm still going to continue to do that? And is she still in it?
Well, like Eliza says in the film, you know, it's the easiest thing to get into. It's the hardest thing to get out of.
Yeah.
Because, so your options are, you're making $1,200, $1,300 a night doing this sex work. So if you don't do this work because of the fear of repercussions of the court, of arrest, of your pimp, or whatever forces are at play, you can go get a job at Kmart. You can go get a job at Starbucks where you're getting minimum, if not below minimum wage. Mm-hmm. And it's just such challenging, sort of, you know, undervalued and demoralizing work when you are in charge of your life. You're doing what you want to do. You're doing it the way you want to do. And that's why it's also in that scene, like Eliza says, you know, just be careful. Like, do you have clients? Like, don't go back out there right away. Like, just like stick with your clients. Because this woman in particular also said to me, it didn't make it in the film, but I asked her, I was like, how would you call yourself? Everyone's labeling you with these terms. How would you define what you do? And she said, you know, I think of myself as a companion. You know, I have lots of clients who are return clients, and I'm their companion.
Stephanie, you mentioned Eliza, and Eliza Hooks, a GEMS counselor, plays a huge role in the film. And people really, I think, become very impressed and sympathetic to her plight. But it seems that she really has a great heart and is just really trying to help. Explain a little bit about Eliza's role and how you see her, how you know her from doing the film.
So Eliza Hook is a GEMS counselor who is one of the service providers in the court. And so her role in the court is the judge and the defense and the prosecutor assign each of these women counseling sessions with a culturally appropriate program. And so Eliza is one of those programs. And, you know, when we first met Eliza, she literally looked me up and down, was like, yeah, I know you're kind. I have no desire to be part of anything that you're doing, because she used to work in film. She had lived many, many lives, doing many different kinds of things. In fact, while we were filming on the weekends, she would work at the Gap. And I
what?
Would
wow. what?
To go and see her at the Gap. Yeah. Wait. She was like one of the people who were on the floor at the Gap, like, you know, putting clothes away, helping you find things. And I think that is what makes her ability to do her compassionate work. So, like, that's what makes her able to do this job. She's done so many different things, and she comes at life from so many different angles. She's not an easy life. And I think that when you come from a place of just challenging circumstances, you have no expectations going to other people's lives, expecting them to just, like, you know, be so grateful or be so happy to have you in their lives. You know that you have to work really hard to gain their trust and to relate to them. And they're not going to relate to you right away. It's going to take them many times and many different actions of on your behalf before they're going to start confiding in you and telling you anything that is of real substance, in which ways then she can help them.
Now,
I mean, she's an amazing woman, period.
It sounds like it. And, you know, just by seeing her in the film, I think people think that way. You've just given us a little more insight into her background. Now, you're co-founder of Once in a Blue Films, and you have done a lot of commercial directing for large companies, corporations like Facebook and ESPN and Tiffany's and Apple, Nickelodeon, CNN, MTV. When you are facing this type of so truthful, meaningful, and poignant stories, how do you juxtapose that with your life as a commercial director versus in Blown Up, which is really a service for so many people?
So I take my role as a filmmaker very seriously, and it's very expensive. So I have to do this other work to sustain my artistic senses and do what I really want to do, which is tell other people's stories and do creative work. But I take what I learned from my independent work back into the commercial world and call people out when they are making blanket statements about communities or people, because they do come to me because of my ability to capture intimate, honest stories. And so when they give me briefs or tell me to do certain things, I'm like, yeah, we can do that. But that's not their truth. And that's what you want me to do. So this is how I can get their truth, I think. I'm not sure if it's going to work or not. But I need more time. I need this. I need that. So, you know, it's a constant balance. But I do take what I do very seriously in terms of using it as a form of education for everyone, in terms of, you know, how we go in and tell people stories.
Question about Backpage, because I was reading an article and you talked about the fact that Backpage kept some people safe during prostitution. But every single person that worked in trafficking, I mean, that against trafficking, wanted that down. And I remember even the people who owned it wouldn't even show up for their own Senate hearings. And so many people sued and tried to get that site down, and it wouldn't come down. Now it's down. At least as far as I know, it's still down. And then I heard you saying, well, now there's going to be some problems for people that do this, and it's going to take away a safety net. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so the sex working spectrum is vast. You know, there are many different kinds of sex workers out there, and there are a lot of young people who are commercially sexually exploited. And so for that population of young girls, I mean, the closing of Backpage has been a blessing, and it has helped get a lot of young girls out of the life.
Yeah.
However, there is this other side of the spectrum of women who have agency, who've been doing sex work for a really long time, and this is their way of reaching clients and not being out on the streets, not being vulnerable to just any Johns or any police vice detectives posing as John.
Right.
So, you know, from my conversations that I've been having with sex workers based on this film, you know, they have all told me how much more challenging it has become for them to do their work, but also how much more unsafe it has become, because it's forced them to go farther underground. And the farther underground you go, the farther you are exposing yourself to just not honest people.
Right.
You know, we only have a minute, Stephanie. I just wanted to ask you this because I saw with interest Vogue says about Blown Up, a work full of hope. That's what Vogue says, a work full of hope. How do you describe the hope that you see from a film like Blown Up?
So I, as an artist, I'm interested in the institutions that surround us and the institutions that educate us. And I think that they're so fascinating because they can do so much harm, in my experience. But I think at the same time, they can do a lot of good because when they're run by a group of people that are like full of compassion and humanity. And so for me, this court system, this courtroom in particular, is a work full of hope because it's run by a group of women who are very different, who played very different roles in this system, and who have very different dilemmas about this issue of prostitution, sex work, and human trafficking. However, regardless of their dilemmas and their personal differences, they are working together to do whatever they can in their role to make this woman's life better.
Yeah,
without judgment.
That makes a lot of sense. How can people see Blown Up?
So Blown Up is playing in theaters right now in New York City at the Quad Cinema until Thursday, April 11th, and then I will be arriving in New York on April 12th for our week-long screenings at the Lemley Music Hall in Beverly Hills, and I'll be doing talkbacks and interesting discussions with sex workers, with Asian American massage parlor workers, as well as the women in film in LA about different aspects of the film.
Okay, I think so you said you were arriving in New York. Awesome. You meant to say LA.
Yes, arriving in LA. So I'm in New York and in the middle of the screening right now.
Right. So you're talking about LA April 12th at the Lemley Beverly Hills, correct?
Yes, until April 17th.
Yeah. Awesome.
All right. Is there a website that people can go to if they want to partake?
Yes, please. Please come out to blownupfilm.com and follow us on social media where you can get like the latest updates and hear about our latest guests and special appearances there.
All right, great.
Thank
Stephanie,
you.
Good luck with Blown Up and all your other films. Stephanie Wong Brial, thanks for being with us on Gervie's Law today.
Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
No problem. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Carrie and I will talk for a few minutes. Then later, we're going to have Philip Margolin on, who is a New York Times best-selling legal thriller author of about 22 books, and he's got a new book coming out. You don't want to miss that. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com. Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, we're back.
Funky music.
The look.
Yeah, I'm dancing.
The look. You know, Carrie, I don't often have time to just sit and talk with you for a few minutes. We have Phil Margolin coming up, and a lot of you know he's a very well-known legal thriller writer. He was an attorney who turned into an author, and he's had 22 books that have come out. New York Times best-selling author. His newest book is called The Perfect Alibi, and we're going to talk to him about that in a few minutes. But before we do, you know, I know you have your conference coming up. Every year you have the Kasem Cares Conference.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about it, because I know that it's important to you.
Yeah. So I started this foundation 6 years ago to change the laws in this country so there's more protection for our elderly and to keep the family unit together. Because once you turn 18 in this country, you have absolutely no rights to see your parents. And people don't know that. Literally no rights. So if you're in a residential home or an assisted living and you have an uncooperative caretaker, which could be a wife, a second wife, a husband, second husband, another sibling, could be just a caretaker, somebody with power of attorney. If they don't want you seeing your mom or dad, they don't want, even if it's the house you grew up in, literally, if it's a house you grew up in, you go knock on the door, they can say, you're not going to see your mom or dad again. And there's nothing you can do about it. You can take them to court if you've got hundreds of thousands of dollars. You might win, you might not. But yeah, there's no laws protecting that. And this is the only time I've ever seen hearsay actually admissible, where you'll find the caretaker, sometimes, you know, in my case, it was a second wife, come in and say horrible things and vilify the children and the people that love, you know, vilify the entire family in our case. And the judge, well, okay, there's no, where's the proof? Show me the evidence of this. Show me. And so what we had to do was we had to prove that we were good kids, and we did. And we proved that she was a pathological liar, and I eventually won. But I won a case I was told I'd never win. So I realized doing this that there's no protection for people, especially if you don't have any money. You can't go to court. So I've been changing the laws. I've changed the laws in 12 states.
And you have a conference coming up.
I do. And that's what this is about. It's about, you know, how to protect yourself, how to, you know, everywhere from how to really plan for retirement to how to protect your family, your mom and dad, if they're getting older, how to protect yourself if you're
getting
older.
Is it open to the public?
It is. And you go to KasemCares.org. That's K-A-S-E-M, Kasem, cares.org or .com. It'll get you there. And you can get the tickets. So we actually closed them because we sold out, but I think we added another 20 tickets.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So people have to act fast, and it's next week.
Next week, 15th and 16th, and lawyers also can get credits.
Yeah, MCLE credits.
That's right.
Yeah, so if you're a lawyer listening, MCLE credits.
We've got quite a few lawyers going, but we've combined with the California District Attorneys Association. So not only are we speaking on the first day in front of district attorneys, police officers that deal with elder abuse, adult protective services, social workers, we have lawyers, we have people that have been, you know, survivors or victims of this. So it's really, if you're dealing with this, if you're having trouble seeing mom or dad, you're dealing with a caretaker, this is a conference you need to go to.
You need to go to it.
KasemCares.org. That's right.
And I have a couple minutes here, and typically I don't say too much. A lot of people don't even know that I'm a workers' compensation attorney. And this week, Carrie, I have to tell you, I have a really quiet week. It's the first time in months and
years.
Quiet,
did you say?
Quiet.
You never have quiet
weeks.
I'm
in the office. So I am telling everyone, if they want to call me with their workers' compensation case, I'm happy to talk to them.
Wait,
all
how
week
is that
long.
Possible?
I'm not in court. Next week, I'll be in court all week, and then I'm going out of town. I have a conference in Hawaii. But I'll tell you, I have this week. So if you have a workers' comp case, if you have a lawyer that you just can't stand that's doing a terrible job, call me up and I'll talk to you about it. And I'll tell you whether you need to get a new lawyer.
I've sent you many people.
Yes, you have.
Yeah.
You sent me a real crazy person the other day.
God.
She was nuts.
Oh, God.
I'm sorry. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, God.
Thank you for that. Yeah, we get so many referrals. I get a lot of referrals from attorneys all over the city, from doctors, everywhere, because we have this reputation. I've been doing this a long time. I have a lot of big cases that I've won and a lot of big settlements. So if you have a work comp case, I never say it, but check us out, rgwlawfirm.com, or call us at 855-4-RGW-LAW, 855-4-RGW-LAW.
It's Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn, rgwlaw.com.
Or 818-981-9960. I'm happy to talk about your cases. If you just got injured, I'm sorry to hear that, but you probably need an attorney. Last thing, if you want to see the Gervey's Law picture and ad at Sunrise Little League in Woodland Hills. Carrie looks amazing.
I'm going to put it up.
I'll take a picture. It's okay. On the outfield wall or the outfield fence where you hit home runs over.
Yes.
And someone came up to me and said, boy, that was a long time ago when you took that picture.
No, they didn't.
It really hurt
no,
me.
Oh.
I just said it was a good photographer.
It is, actually. He's a great photographer.
Yeah.
But give it again.
Michael
R-G-W
Helms.
Law, because you talk so fast. R, like rat. G,
right.
Like gat.
G, like what? Like,
gat. Like I got my gat.
Goat.
No, gat. See,
Rowan Gervey
Wayman knows. Right, Wayman knows what I'm talking about.
Oh boy, did you just say rat when you compare
rat,
that law
firm? Rat, gat, and what's the W stand
okay,
for?
Enough,
win.
Enough. Win. We win.
That's
RGW
right.
Law Firm, Rowan Gervey and Win. If you have a workers' comp case, call me this week only. I'm doing a special. I'm in the office, 818-981-9960. I'm happy to talk to you and to give you some advice.
That's hilarious.
All right, so we're going to take a quick break now for the bottom of the hour news break, and then we'll be back with Philip Margolin, New York Times best-selling author of legal thrillers. Don't miss it.
Welcome back to Gervy's Law. Still thinking about what can go wrong? Instead, let's get excited about what can go right on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about Carrie calling my law firm a rat.
No, I'm just
RGW
the acronym.
Is in rat.
Yeah, rat, gat, and win.
Gat. Rat. That's all I'm thinking about. Not thinking about what can go right.
Okay.
I'm thinking about what can go wrong. We just changed the theme of the show.
We could do RGW Law. Could be radio.
Okay, whatever.
George. Win.
Okay, now you're really starting to struggle
trying
here.
To help here.
All right, let's turn to something a little more productive than you trying to figure out what RGW actually stands for as an acronym.
Rowan Gervey and Win.
We're pleased to have with us on Gervey's Law right now, Philip Margolin, who is a New York Times best-selling author, and he is a household name for those who like legal thrillers. He's written about 22 of them, some of them being Gone But Not Forgotten. And by the way, Gone But Not Forgotten was made into a TV miniseries back in 2004 with Brooke Shields and Scott Glenn, and Lost Lake and Violent Crimes. I come out with a new one. People have been waiting a long time for this, Perfect Alibi, which is a follow-up to his book from last year, the Robin Lockwood, the Third Victim book. He has been an attorney for many years, criminal defense, covered or involved with about 30 murder trials, and now he is a best-selling author. Phil Margolin, welcome to Gervey's Law.
Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. I just want to ask you one thing because it was really interesting. I was reading an interview with you, and the interviewer, whoever he was, said something about there's so many attorneys who turn into writers. And I'm glad you caught him on that because you said, well, that's really not that true. I don't understand why you said that because I know a lot of lawyers. I spend my life with lawyers all day long, and there aren't a whole lot of them who are best-selling authors. We did have Scott Turow on our show, which is someone who has done quite well writing. But when you got into it, this is something that was not a normal thing for people to do, even if you loved Perry Mason books.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and I talk about this. Before 1987, there was no such thing as a legal thriller. If you had a book with a lawyer and a murder, it was called a murder mystery, and nobody paid any attention to it. And it's interesting you brought up Scott Turow, because he is the fellow who's responsible for starting this genre. When he wrote Presumed Innocent, the publisher had, for R. Strauss and Giroux, had a problem because it was about a lawyer and a murder, and no one took those books seriously. They didn't get reviewed by the New York Times and make the bestseller list. And so they thought up a marketing tool, and they said, well, we won't call it a murder mystery. We'll call it a legal thriller, a book that gives the reader an inside look at how the law works because it was written by a lawyer. And that really caught on and really started the whole craze. And I think the reason people think that all lawyers also have novels published is because if you're a lawyer and you write a novel, they really play that up for publicity purposes.
You know, this book sounds so good, The Perfect Alibi. Just everything.
And it just came out.
Yes. No, it sounds fantastic. The twists, the turns, just reading about it. Do you ever take, I'm sure there's got to be some inspiration from the cases you've worked on, but anything ripped right out of a book or right out of a case that you put into a book?
You know, I do that off and on. My fifth book, The Burning Man, was based on a murder case that I handled in the mid-'80s. My first book, Heartstone, was based on the Peyton Allen murders in Oregon. Most of the time, though, what I do is I collect newspaper articles, articles from law journals, or maybe just an idea I get, and I put in an idea file. I quit practicing in 96, but I kept my law office to write in, and this idea file's right next to my desk. So for The Perfect Alibi, back about, gosh, I'm going to say almost 17 years ago, I came across a scam that a guy pulled in Milwaukee that involved DNA, and I thought it was just amazingly creative, and I'd always wanted to use it in a book, and I couldn't think of what to do with it right off the top of my head, so I threw it in my idea file, and then when I finished the first Robin Lockwood, the third victim, I was trying to think of what new book I would write. I pulled out the hundreds of pages from my idea file, and I came across this article and then a number of other very interesting articles about DNA, and I decided that I would work a story around that. So most of the time, though, it's just the ideas come out of my sick imagination.
I remember actually hearing about that case. It may not have been that exact one, but where a man was in jail and he swore that he did not do this, but the DNA was found. But then he's in jail and it's found again on another.
Don't tell how it works, though. It's like a magician giving away a trick.
Don't say that.
No, I'm not going to say anything.
But it's funny because you're focusing on the DNA, and for those people who aren't as familiar with the book, but they can be buying it or getting it as soon as you. It just came out March 5th, right? So it's
And it's all over the place. You can get it on Kindle or on Barnes and Noble or bookstores, and it's on audio and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, so it talks about, in the book, there it's a premises, Robin Lockwood, former MMA fighter, of course, which that brings in some interest for the MMA crowd. But defending an athlete who's accused of raping a woman and then was sent to prison. When you were formulating these ideas, you're talking about the file you go to, you know, you talk about the DNA. But there's also a lot of interest over the last couple of years, and we focused on it on the show many times with Bill Cosby case, Harvey Weinstein case, and a lot of other cases of the Me Too generation. When you talk about defending an athlete who was accused of raping a woman, was there any thoughts of everything that's going on with, you know, and Kavanaugh, the Kavanaugh hearings, which we talked a lot about when they were going on for the Supreme Court justice, any kind of trying to capitalize on these issues that are not necessarily DNA, but also very much on the forefront of people's minds?
Well, I wouldn't say capitalize on it. Obviously, this is something that's you read about every day. And so when I was trying to set up the plot of the book, that is something that was in the forefront of my mind. The idea of having a star athlete, in this case, a All-American linebacker from the University of Oregon, accused of rape, and then what happens in the rape case, and then what happens later on involving it. So, yeah, that was obviously something that I was thinking about. But I don't make a lot of political statements in the books that I write. I do sometimes use ethical and moral dilemmas that criminal defense lawyers get involved with to make the books more interesting, so that the reader has to say, well, who's the killer? Because all the books have surprise endings and twists and stuff. But they also say, well, if I was the lawyer, how would I handle this moral dilemma?
You know, it's interesting you say that because there's been so many reviews of the book, and if you go to Goodreads, you'll see they're mostly all excellent, stellar reviews. One of them talks about one of his twistiest, most compelling crime novels yet. And you talk about twistiest and compelling. Perhaps you're not focusing on politics, but you're certainly focusing on the permutations and combinations of things that could happen that people just don't think about. Do you have a lot of fun with that when you're getting twisty?
Well, I was brought up when I was a little kid. I was a voracious reader. I'm talking about elementary school. And the Ellery Queen murder mysteries were the ones that I loved the most. And in those books, there are clues. And if you can get the clues, you can figure out who the killer is. And Ellery Queen was two people that wrote it under that pseudonym. But they actually had a page about nine-tenths of the way through the book that would say, challenge to the reader, you now know, have all the clues as to who the killer is, so can you figure it out? And so I love that type of a book. And so when I write, I use, what I do is I get an idea, and that's the hardest thing for me, to get an idea that's complex enough to fill up a 400-page book. And then once I get the idea, I do a very extensive outline, and I usually won't write anything till I've got the ending, because that's the most important part of a book. If you read a book or see a movie that's fabulous, but it has a stupid ending, you know, you get really mad and feel like you waste your money. If you read a book or see a movie that's okay, but it has a fabulous ending, you really feel like you got your money's worth. So I won't literally write a word till I've got the ending. Executive Privilege, one of my most successful novels, I got the idea in 1995. Couldn't think of the ending, so I didn't write it until 2005.
Wow.
Wow.
And then once I get the idea and the ending, then I do a outline that takes me usually 1 to 3 months. And that's, I'm talking about being in my, kept my office to write in, so I get down to the office, and I'm talking about maybe 6 hours a day of just thinking about the book. And I work my way all the way through the book, setting up the twist, the red herrings, and the other stuff that I hope will make the book interesting.
So, okay, when you're thinking about that, when you're creating and you're sitting there, are you just writing things down on a piece of paper, whatever comes up, and then piecing it together afterward? Or is it like, here's a thought, here's a complete thought, I'm going to write this down and then see if the ending works with it?
Well, usually what I do is I play a lot of Freecell. So on my computer, it's like slogging through mud doing the outline. I'll get an idea for, you know, the first chapter, and then it's, you know, how do I push it forward? That for me is really, really the hard work. Once the outline's done, the book's basically written in shorthand, so the writing part's a snap. But getting all the way through to the end of the outline and setting up the twist, and then a lot of times something you think is really brilliant, after you've been thinking about it for a while, you realize it's really not that smart after all. You have to go backwards and you know, erase it and stuff.
So start again.
Yeah, and it's fun. I mean, I love doing it, but that's the real hard work for me. And you know, I keep on getting depressed, and I say, Phil, you know, you already have one book in the can. You'll be all right.
You've got 21 books in the can. You'll do it.
You got a couple of years to write the thing. Relax.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't get uptight.
Phil, we got to take a quick break, but we want to talk after the break. You live in Portland, a New Yorker. How does a New Yorker fall in love with Portland? We'll talk a little more about The Perfect Alibi and how that's come out with Robin Lockwood, and whether or not maybe we're going to see Robin Lockwood maybe in a future book. So we'll talk about that after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Hey,
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Yeah, wow. We got some good music today, Wayman. Thank you.
I love it. Wayman laughs.
Is this one fine morning I wake up? Oh, okay. Same thing.
Well, hey.
I'll tell you about it after. We don't have time.
Okay, fine. Announce the show.
What show is that?
Gervey's Law.
Oh, okay, Gervey's Law. We're talking to Phil Margolin. He's a New York Times bestseller of legal thrillers. The newest book is called The Perfect Alibi, and it chronicles really young, with it, hot Robin Lockwood. I added the hot.
Hot? Well, she does MMA, so yes, I think that's pretty cool.
You know, so, Phil, you introduced Robin Lockwood in your last book, The Third Victim, very popular, and that was about Alex Mason, who was an attorney accused of murder. And Robin was working with Regina Barrister, who was the lead counsel, and she kind of took over there. Is this something that you see in the future? Are you going to really focus on Robin Lockwood now as you move forward?
Yeah, actually, I just signed a new 3-book contract with St. Martin's for 3 more Robins, and the book after Perfect Alibi, which is one I had the most fun ever writing, is in New York being edited. And the reason I say I had so much fun with it, I love magic, and in the book, which is tentatively called The Chamber of Death, that's a big magic illusion. A magician is murdered on stage in front of a full house at a big theater, and you don't know who the killer is. And he's killed while he's doing his biggest magic illusion, the Chamber of Death. So that was real. I had to learn how to do stage magic.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I'm looking.
I'm obsessed with magic.
We both are.
Yeah.
I actually did in law school, I did a thesis on trade secrets and magicians. I'm one of the only people who ever did that because I lived with, at the time, Ed Alonzo, who was on Saved by the Bell.
Yeah, yeah.
Very well-known magician. He's been on the show. We've had a number of the Bornsteins on the show. We've had a lot of Magic Castle people.
Larry Soffer.
Yes. I've been to the Magic Castle, and it's really funny that you mentioned that, the trademark thing, because in the book, the magician at the very first chapter comes to Robin and asks her if she can patent a magic trick, magic illusions. Uh-huh. And it turns out I had to do research on that. And the good news and the bad news is, A, you can get a patent for a magic illusion, but B, in order to get the patent, you have to say in the documents how
it's
works.
Done.
Right,
I know.
Exactly.
You have to reveal
secret.
Everything, and then that patent goes to the public after a while.
Yeah, Phil, you could have told me that. Well, I didn't know you were doing this book. I would have sent you my thesis. It's all in there. Everything is in my thesis. Things haven't changed in many years since I did that.
Yeah, book's written already, but I am sorry.
The book's written.
Saved me a lot of research.
Yeah, I could have saved
you
some
helped
time.
You
could have been working on those twists on your computer. That sounds like a fascinating book. Now, you're working with St. Martin's now. The Perfect Alibi was with Minotaur Books, and before you were with HarperCollins.
Yeah, I was with Harper for quite some time and then switched over. Keith Kayla is a fabulous editor over at Minotaur and St. Martin's. It's the same company.
Okay.
I call them St. Martin's.
You call them St. Martin's.
But But it's the same company, and really fortunate to have Keith. He's a terrific editor, and I've been having a lot of fun working with him.
So you talk about your love that you've developed for magic, and you have a love for Portland, Oregon, and it's interesting mm-hmm. because it seems to be a very unique place for you to be doing all this. What is it about Portland that gives you that creative juice?
Well, the first thing is I'm looking out of my window right now in my condo, and it's a dark and stormy night. So when I put down that the first in the book, it was a dark and stormy night. I'm not lying. No, I got out here by luck. In between college and law school, I was in the Peace Corps in Liberia, West Africa for wow. 2 years. And we did our training. This is when the Peace Corps first started. We did our training in San Francisco. And I grew up in New York and went to college in Washington, D.C., so I'd never been off the East Coast. And I fell in love with San Francisco and decided that I would go to Africa for 2 years, come back east for law school, but then get out as quick as I could. And they had a clerkship committee at NYU Law School, and they would apply for you, so I said, well, send my name to guys in Oregon and Washington and California. I had no idea where Oregon was even.
You didn't know how to pronounce it properly, that's for sure.
I didn't initially, no. People say it's Oregon,
yeah,
and
Oregon.
That's what I was saying. Yeah. We had to look it up on a map, and fortunately, I was hired by Herb Schwab, who was the chief judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals. Fabulous mentor, and the deal was we'd go, my wife and I would go out there. If we liked it, we'd stay. If we didn't, we'd use it as a base of operations, look at California and Washington. And if we still didn't, we'd go back to New York. And it turned out we just fell in love with Oregon. So it's gorgeous. We have fabulous mountains and desert and the ocean, anything you could want. And the city itself is terrific. When I first moved out, there was no good restaurants, no theater, no nothing, basically, but it was a really nice place to live. And now we're like one of the food mm-hmm. cities in the country, and we have good theater and anything else you could possibly want. So
I love it there.
I sound like the Chamber of Commerce.
No, it's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous.
I think
out there.
They'll give you a little stipend for that. So that's that's it. Now, I just quickly before we leave, I do want to mention Chess for Success, because I don't know if you're still involved with it, but it's such an interesting. It's a great initiative to help kids learn skills for success in school and in life. Tell us a little bit about Chess for Success.
Yeah, this is my real passion. I was one of the three founders back in 1992, and I'm still on the board. Chess is the single best educational tool, pound for pound. There's a reason for it. After four moves on either side of a game of chess, the number of potential moves is an astronomically high number. And we put chess, we're currently in 87 Title I elementary schools. Title I are the poorest schools. 70% of our kids are minority. Most of them qualify for free food, breakfast and lunch. And we use chess to teach them thinking skills that they can use in school, but also in life. Because of the situation after a few moves in the game, in order to figure out the right move, a kid has to sit with his feet on the floor, totally focus on what move he's going to make, analyze every possibility, and then come to a conclusion to recheck it. And if you think about it, that's what an elementary school kid has to do to read a book with comprehension, solve math problems, basically anything you do as a lawyer. If you have a problem and you focus on it and analyze it unemotionally and objectively, your chance of getting the right answer goes up. So
have you found any
4,000
Bobby Fischers? Because we have to go soon. Have you found any Bobby Fischers? That's what I want to know.
We That's the exact opposite. We are totally disinterested in,
Competition?
No, I like that. No, I want to tell you because, you know, it's interesting. I read somewhere that you had said, and I really appreciate this comment and thank you for it. You said, talking about attorneys, lawyers, you said most are out there trying to do the right thing. And that is really important. And I know with Chess for Success, you are doing the right thing in helping kids improve their skills in school and life. The book is called The Perfect Alibi. Phil Margolin, it's just been a real pleasure being with you today.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, same here. I really enjoyed the interview. Aww.
Okay, thanks so much, and good luck with it. I'm going to be looking for Chamber of Death next year. All right, take care, and thanks for listening. Gervie's Law, we'll see you next week.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.